thinner and more shiny. I could not tell their sex, but I noticed immediately that the cub with the lightest coat was much livelier and more inquisitive than the other two, and especially devoted to its mother. It always cuddled close up to her, if possible under her chin, and embraced her with its little paws. Elsa was very gentle and patient with her family, and allowed them to crawl all over her and chew her ears and tail. Gradually, she moved closer to me, and seemed to be inviting me to join in their game. But when I wriggled my fingers in the sand, the cubs, though they cocked their round foxy faces, kept their distance. When it got dark, Elsa listened attentively, and then took the cubs some yards into the bush. A few moments later, I heard the sound of suckling. I returned to camp, and when I arrived it was wonderful to find Elsa and the cubs waiting for me, about 10 yards from the tent. I patted her and she licked my hand. Then I called the Toto, and together we brought the remains of the carcass up from the river. Elsa watched us, and it seemed to me that she was pleased that we were relieving her of the task of pulling the heavy load. But when we came within 20 yards of her, she suddenly rushed at us with flattened ears. I told the boy to drop the meat and remain still, and I began to drag it near to the cubs. When she saw that I was handling the kill alone, Elsa was reassured, and as soon as I deposited it, she started eating. After watching her for a while, I went to my tent and was surprised to see her following me. She flung herself on the ground and called to the cubs to come and join me, but they remained outside meowing. Soon she went back to them and so did I. We all sat together on the grass, Elsa leaning against me while she suckled her family. Suddenly, two of the cubs started quarrelling over a teat. Elsa reacted by rolling into a position which gave them better access. In doing so, she came to rest against me and hugged me with one paw, including me in her family. The evening was very peaceful. The moon rose slowly, and the down palms were silhouetted against the light. There was not a sound, except for the suckling of the cubs. So many people had warned me that after Elsa's cubs had been born, she would probably turn into a fierce and dangerous mother, defending her young. Yet here she was, trusting and as affectionate as ever, and wanting me to share her happiness. I felt very humble. George returned on the 4th of February, and was delighted to hear the good news of the cubs. In the afternoon, we walked towards the Woofing Rock, so named because it was there that we had once surprised her with her mate and had been startled by their alarming woofing, hoping that he too might see them. On our way, we heard the agitated barking of baboons. We thought it very likely that Elsa's presence was the cause of the commotion, so as we approached the river we called out to her. She appeared immediately. But though she was very friendly, she was obviously upset and rushed nervously backwards and forwards between us and the bush, which grew along the river's edge. She seemed to be doing her best to prevent us from reaching the water. We assumed that her cubs were there, and were surprised that she should try to prevent George from seeing them. In the end, she led us back to the camp by a wide detour. We realized that she made a difference between bringing the cubs to see us and our visiting them. 2 weeks passed before she brought the cubs to camp to introduce them to George. This was not entirely her fault, for during this time we were obliged to go to Isiolo for a couple of days, and while we were away, she and the cubs had arrived at the camp one morning looking for us, but had only found the boys. Makede told us that he had gone to meet her, and she had rubbed her head against his legs, and one plucky cub had boldly walked up to within a short distance of him. Makede was delighted. He said he was sure it was a male, and told me he'd given it a name, which was, he said, very popular with the Meru tribe. It sounded like Jesper. I asked him, and the other boys, where the name came from. They said it was out of the Bible, but as each boy pronounced it slightly differently, it was difficult for me to trace it. The nearest phonetic association I could find was Jafta, which means God sets free. If that were the origin of the little cub's name, it could not be more appropriate. Later, when we knew that the family consisted of two lions and a lioness, we called Jasper's brother, who was very shy, Gopa, for in Swahili this means timid, and his sister we named little Elsa. The next day, I woke up to hear Elsa's typical cub moan coming from across the river. I jumped out of bed and was just in time to see her crossing with her cubs. I collected some meat, and while they ate, Elsa talked continuously to the cubs in a series of low moans. They often suckled, but also chewed at the meat. Elsa did not regurgitate any meat for them, though considering the vast amount that she'd eaten lately, when she came alone to the camp, it seemed likely that she might have regurgitated some later in the day for the benefit of the cubs. But this is speculation. We never saw her doing it. On the 19th of February, George greeted me with the news that he had seen the cubs. That morning, he woke up while it was still dark and heard quick, short lapping sounds, as well as long laps, coming from the direction of Elsa's water bowl. He looked out and saw the cubs dimly outlined around the bowl. A few minutes later, they all went off. By the time the cubs were 10 weeks, Elsa had begun to wean them. Whenever she thought they'd had enough milk, she either sat on her teats or jumped onto the roof of the Land Rover. So if the cubs did not want to starve, they had to eat meat. That evening, one cub was determined to get some milk and persistently pushed its way under Elsa's belly until she became really angry, gave it a good spank and jumped onto the car. The little ones resented this very much. They stood on their hind legs, resting their forepaws against the car, meowing up at their mother, but she sat and licked her paws, as though she were quite unaware of the whimpering cubs below. For several nights, we had terrific thunderstorms, and the lightning and the crashes came so close together that I was quite frightened. The water poured down as though it were flowing through a pipe. As George's tent was empty, Elsa and the cubs could very well have sheltered in it, but the youngsters' inbred fear of man was so great that they preferred to soak outside. This trait was the most obvious sign of their wild blood, and it was something we were determined to encourage, even in defiance of Elsa's wish to make them into friends of ours. The last thing I wanted was that they should become tame. It seemed that our rearing of their mother in domesticity had in no way impaired the instinct which all wild animals possess, and which warns them against approaching an unknown danger. Moreover, Elsa herself had shown by concealing her cubs from us for 5 or 6 weeks that her own instinct for protecting her young was still alive. Now she was plainly disappointed that her efforts to make one pride of us were proving unsuccessful, partly owing to the cubs' fear of man, and partly owing to what she must have taken as heartless lack of cooperation on our part. She seemed very puzzled, but had no intention of giving up her plan. One evening, she entered my tent, deliberately lay down behind me, and then called softly to the cubs, inviting them to suckle her. By doing this, she tried not only to make the cubs come into the tent, but also to force them to pass close to me. No doubt they would have been pleased if I'd retired behind their mother, and she would have been pleased if I'd done something to encourage them, but I remained where I was and kept still. To have moved would have defeated Elsa's intention, and to have encouraged them would have been against our determination not to tame them. I was sorry, because I longed to help the cubs, and felt distressed when Elsa looked at me for a long time with a disappointed expression in her eyes, and then went out to join her children. She plainly thought me unfeeling, whereas I was suppressing all my feelings for the good of her family. The cubs were worried about our relationship for the opposite reason, and became anxious every evening when Elsa, persecuted by tsetse flies, flung herself in front of me, asking me to dispose of these pests. When I started squashing the flies, and in the process slapping Elsa, the cubs were very upset. Jasper, in particular, would come close and crouch, ready to spring should his mother be in need of protection. No doubt they found it odd that she should seem grateful for my slappings. By now, Elsa had won the hearts of thousands of people and became famous overnight. It was gratifying, but we feared she might have to share the fate of all celebrities. Lack of privacy. People from all over the world wrote saying they would like to come and see her. After all the trouble we'd taken to keep her and the cubs wild, we could not agree to Elsa and her family being turned into a tourist attraction. We could, of course, appeal to her admirers, to sportsmen and to our friends not to invade her privacy, but we had no legal means of keeping people out, and we were very worried in case some visitor should, in our absence, provoke Elsa and accidentally cause trouble. The way in which the cubs were developing into true wild lions exceeded our hopes, but their father was a great disappointment to us. No doubt we were partly to blame, for we had interfered with his relationship with his family, but certainly he was of no help as a provider of food for them. On the contrary, he often stole their meat. Moreover, he caused us a lot of trouble. One evening, he made a determined attempt to get at a goat which was inside my truck, and another time when Elsa and the cubs were eating outside our tent, she suddenly scented him, became very nervous, sniffed repeatedly towards the bush, cut her meal short and hurriedly removed the cubs. George went out with a torch to find out what the trouble was. He had not gone 3 yards when he was startled by a fierce growl and saw the cub's father hiding in a bush just in front of him. He retreated rapidly, and luckily so did the lion. Nuru had only just returned to us. He had been home for 6 months because he had suffered from an internal illness. Now he was well again, but he blamed Elsa for his sickness. This surprised me, as he had always been very devoted to her, but it seemed that the onset of his malady had coincided with the time at which we had engaged him to look after Elsa and her 2 sisters. Because of this, he was convinced that she had cast the evil eye on him. It was to dispel this belief that I was now taking him to the camp with me. As we waited in the drizzling rain, I told him about the cubs, and he seemed very interested. During the night, the river fell, so we were able to reach camp in the early hours of the morning. Elsa, attracted by vibrations of the car, gave us a welcome, which, in our exhausted state, we found almost too boisterous. In the afternoon, hoping to be able to show Nuru the cubs, we all walked in their direction. Suddenly, we heard Elsa talking to them in the bush just ahead of us. Soon she came bouncing out, and after greeting us made a great fuss of Nuru. Indeed, she was so overwhelmingly happy to see her old friend again, after such a long absence, that he was very much touched. He began to pat her and discarded all his superstitious fear of her evil eye. After this reunion, he became even more devoted to her than he had been before his illness. She did not, however, show him her cubs on this occasion, and only brought them into camp after dark. On the 2nd of April, George went back to Isiolo, but I stayed on in camp. To prevent predators from stealing the meat during the night, I started dragging the carcass from the down palm near to my tent, to which I attached it to a chain. It was often a heavy load, and Elsa used to watch me, apparently content that I'd taken on the laborious task of protecting her meat. Jesper was much less happy when he saw me handling the kill. After several half-hearted attacks, he sometimes charged me in a proper fashion, first crouching low and then rushing forward at full speed. Elsa came instantly to my rescue. She not only placed herself between her son and me, but gave him a sound and deliberate cuff. Afterwards, she sat with me in the tent for a long time, totally ignoring Jesper, who rested outside looking bewildered. Touched as I was by Elsa's reaction, I also understood that Jesper should be disconcerted by his mother's disapproval of his instinctive reaction, and I was most anxious not to arouse his jealousy. He was still too small to do very much harm, but we both recognized that it was essential to establish a friendly truce with the cubs while they were still dependent upon us for food, and before they'd grown big enough to be dangerous. It was a difficult problem, because while we did not want them to be hostile, neither did we want them to become tame. Recently, Elsa herself seemed to have become aware of our difficulty, and to be making her contribution to solving it. While she spanked Jesper, if in his attempts to protect her, he attacked me, she also dealt firmly with me if she thought I was getting too familiar with her children. For instance, several times when I came close to them while they were at play, she looked at me through half-closed eyes, walked slowly but purposefully up to me, and gripped me round the knees in a friendly but determined manner, which indicated very plainly that her grip would become much firmer if I did not take a hint and retire. One night, Elsa, observing that the boys had forgotten to place thorn branches in front of the entrance to my enclosure, pushed the wicker gate aside, entered the tent, and promptly lay down on my bed. Wrapped up in the torn mosquito netting, she looked so content that I saw myself having to spend the night sitting in the open. Jesper followed his mother into the tent and stood on his hind legs examining the bed, but fortunately decided against trying it out. The other cubs stayed outside. We spent most of the evening trying to lure Elsa out of my tent. For some time our hopes of success were pretty dim, then I began to imitate the noises the cubs make, and to flash my torch round the camp pretending that they were lost. This soon caused both Elsa and Jesper to rush out. I now had my tent to myself, but was unable to sleep because Elsa noisily attacked my truck. However, as on a previous occasion, to my surprise she stopped when I shouted, "No, Elsa, no!" to her. I could not understand why she went for the goat's truck, for if she were hungry, there was still some meat down by the river. The cubs were about 16 weeks old, and by now the family should have been guarding its kill. Had Elsa become so lazy that she expected us not only to provide her with food, but also to relieve her of the task of protecting it? Were we ruining her wild instincts, and should we leave her? The moment did not seem a propitious one for deserting her, because we'd recently found the footprints of 2 strange Africans very near the camp. No doubt they'd been reconnoitering our whereabouts, for the drought was again with us and probably they intended to bring their stock into the game reserves to graze, though this was illegal. In the circumstances, I felt I must go on providing the family with food. If not, Elsa would surely kill some trespassing goat. I comforted myself with the thought that very soon the rains would come. The tribesmen would go away, and by the next dry season, Elsa would have the cubs well on the run to hunt with her. Meanwhile, I was immensely interested in observing their development. Already they stretched their tendons. They stood on their hind legs and dug their claws into the rough bark of certain trees, preferably acacias. When they'd finished this exercise, the bark showed deep gashes. I noticed a curious fact about Elsa. In the past, she had often wetted the ground sheet inside the tent, and even sometimes the canvas roof of the Land Rover. But since she had become a mother, she never permitted herself such bad manners, and made the cubs walk off the path whenever they needed to relieve themselves. The cubs were easily distinguishable. Jesper was much the lightest in colour. His body was perfectly proportioned, and he had a very pointed nose, and eyes so acutely slanted that they gave a slightly Mongolian cast to his sensitive face. His character was not only the most nonchalant, daring and inquisitive, but also the most affectionate. When he was not cuddling up against his mother and clasping her with his paws, he demonstrated his affection to his brother and sister. His timid brother Gopher was also most attractive. He had very dark markings on his forehead, but his eyes, instead of being bright and open like Jesper's, were rather clouded and squinted a little. He was bigger and more heavily built than his brother. Though by no means stupid, he took a long time to make up his mind, and unlike Jesper, was not venturesome. Little Elsa fitted her name, for she was the replica of her mother at the same age. She had the same expression, the same markings, the same slender build. Her behaviour, too, was so strikingly like Elsa's that we could only hope that she would develop the same lovable character. As they were in excellent condition, we thought that we should risk leaving them to hunt with Elsa, anyway, for a few days. Their father had been about lately, and as the family had only come into camp for short feeding visits, We assume that they were spending most of their time with him.